Welcome to episode 56. I think you'll enjoy this episode because I've added a couple of really funny stories, or kind of funny stories, and I did run them by Kona, and she agreed that I should share them. One of my challenges, as I've been sharing my journey, even from the start, is to try not to bore you to death with details that I find interesting and you might find less so. Then I almost sometimes forget to incorporate funny stories to keep the journey balanced. So this week, more stories. But first, let's do a leadership lesson. I'm going to start off with the differing leadership styles of the cadet wing commanders. During my tenure, there were three cadet wing commanders, and they were indeed as different as you would experience in any other organization. After all, leadership is like that. And it's true that, okay, just a minute, Kona. Hi, Kona. Just a minute. Okay, I'm back. I'm going to try to post a photo of where Kona is when she jumps up and interrupts my podcast recording. Anyway, it's true that military leaders have unique differences, and yet at the same time, at the end of the day, leading people, focusing strategically when the system hampers that due to the what did you do for me lately and not what the future will look like, and balancing mission and people have similar successes and challenges. One was focused on bringing a more casual aspect to the wing. He wasn't a laissez-faire leader. It was more descriptive of let's get the job done and still have a good balance, which is a great description of a serious leader. On the surface, the second was a little more reserved, yet he was very willing to make decisions and during his tenure, he was more strategic in looking beyond his time as wing commander. The third wanted to bring more military discipline to the Corps with the added focus of how to look at history, and there is one of the most amazing projects during my 3 years that I'll share in the future that she spearheaded almost completely on her own. Each were both effective and a good learning environment for the leader and his or her staff and the Corps. Leading the Corps is not an easy task since these are your peers and all of a sudden you're in charge of the entire organization. In hindsight, I can't think of a negative aspect to how they led. Rather, I can think of how each brought a distinctive leadership style to the cadet wing in a way that amplified the transitions of leadership that happens far more frequently in the military and that showed how different leaders can be effective and divergent from the last. I've seen it throughout my career, to be sure, and I'm sure you have as well. Turnover of leaders in the military is far greater than those in both other government organizations or public and private ones. For me, it was a real pleasure to watch all the cadets grow professionally and personally over the time that I was at UT, especially in being the best mentor that I could without interfering too much. I will add that if you ask them, there were likely times that my desire to remain as neutral as possible may not have always come through. Oh, yes, that's another challenge of leadership, isn't it? So I promised some stories, and let me premise this by saying, as described last week, there is a time for heads down, pencils up. And this is one of those situations. I was driving home one evening, and I see flashing lights behind me. Now what? The officer comes up to the window and asks me for my license and registration. He says, your registration is expired. I'm thinking, I don't think so. And I just added that I'm in the military, and I'm sure my registration stickers are in the mail, and I can retain my Virginia license and car registration. As info for my civilian listeners, a military member can have a blend of not more than 3 residential scenarios. For example, you can vote in one jurisdiction, different from your driver's license, and have your vehicle registered in a third. Many military members have usually 2 different jurisdictions. His response to my comment was, "You're in Texas now." Okay. Thinking, thank you, so I can retain my Virginia plate, and I decide to refer to the Soldiers and Sailors Act, which is the law that presides in this situation. He repeats, you are in Texas now. Uh-oh, I knew that even though I thought I was in the right, I decided not the time to argue. "Thank you, officer. I'll take care of it." He then just mumbled, "Okay, well, do that." He didn't give me a ticket. I was on my way to a community picnic and checked for the registration stickers. They were out of date, and a neighbor suggested, well, maybe they fell off. I'm sure you're familiar that they can't fall off, and even if they did, they would flake off so they can't be duplicated. Oh well, they were out of date, and since it was within a grace period for some reason, I was able to fix it in short order with the DMV. What I'll never forget is how he said, "You're in Texas now." Now, the next scenario is less an oversight and, let's just say, more my fault. Remember that Gary lived a couple of hours outside of Austin, and if you've been to rural Texas, it's wide open, and the speed limit is simply not high enough. Ask anyone. I'm going along and a bit over the speed limit, and while cadets have to report their traffic infractions to the detachment, luckily, staff don't, since it's a civil matter. So I'm over the speed limit, and I get a ticket. In Texas, and other places too, I believe, you can take a class and present your ticket, and the ticket is held in abeyance for a short period of time, and it just goes away, and it's not reported to your insurance company. So, that's my plan. Now, to schedule these takes a little bit of time, so you just have to wait your turn. Oh, snap. 2 weeks later, I'm coming back and I get pulled over for speeding again. What? I'm thinking this isn't good. And also, thank goodness I don't have to report these. In doing my research earlier, I knew that you can't use the class get out of free card twice. I'm not feeling very good about this until I realize that the ticket is in a different jurisdiction. And in fact, the officer even said, you can go to a class and yada, yada, yada. Alas, while you cannot go to the class for both at the same time, I'm thinking, I'm still golden, right? I just have to go to two classes. Oh, and I decide to go to two classes from two different companies just because. Now, at the class, they tell you that you can give the certificate for the defensive driving course to your insurance company, and they'll give you a discount. And since some of the class attendees are there for the discount and not to forgive a ticket, well, that wasn't my case. And plus, at my age, the insurance company would likely ask, well, why did you go to the class? So I passed on that idea. As luck would have it, I'm coming back from that long journey, not a couple weeks later, and flashing lights once again. Okay, now this is definitely not good. I'm feeling like I'm really going to be in trouble. And in fact, I was going, let's just go with fairly fast. So I'm also just thinking, and I'm sure everyone will agree, why don't they just raise the speed limit? It would solve so many problems. The officer that pulled me over was very nice. In fact, she was almost apologetic. And she said that in the county I was in, that the judge is very understanding, and all you would have to do is call the clerk, and as long as you don't get another ticket within 60 days, it just goes away. You have to pay the fine, but no class needed. Guess what? I actually was in a different jurisdiction. There's a lesson here. The problem was that apparently I was going faster than the allowed over the limit for this special deal to work. Now, this is a trait from my mom. Remember that Dad had the car buzzer at like 45 miles an hour, and Mom turned that dial all the way up to the max. Well, I guess that's where I get it from. Alas, I did have the officer's name, and she, again, was so nice. I decided to write a letter to the court. I explained that I'm very remorseful, and that the very professional officer said I could seek a one-time get-out-of-forgiveness situation. The other tickets are in abeyance because I took the course, so they're just being held. So they're not on my record. Anyway, about a week later, a woman calls, and I could tell that she was quite an older woman. And she said that the judge got your letter, and he's going to honor what the officer told me. It was a very small county. He further said that within 60 days, as long as I don't have infraction in his jurisdiction, it will be completely thrown away. Since that was a curious phrase, I asked a question or two to clarify. And she said, and almost quote, I'm going to put your ticket in this box here on my desk. Then, after 60 days, I'm going to throw it in the trash. Now that's expunging the record. I put a tickler on my calendar, and I call 61 days later. The same woman answers the phone. She remembers me and said, oh, I'm glad you called. Let me check. I could hear her rumple some papers, and she said, yep, I have it right here, and now I'm going to rip it up and throw it away. I thanked her profusely, and that was it. If you're keeping track, yes, I had 3 tickets in less than 5 weeks. None on my insurance and none on my record. Guess what? I have never been pulled over for speeding since. Well, that I can remember. See, you can teach an old dog new tricks. With that, let me update you on the accreditation of ROTC courses at the university. I quickly learned that there were advocates, and there were those that were not advocates. My job was to get all the deans to agree. To change the policy within UT was to pass university legislation to approve academic credit for ROTC courses. Since I had to bring the Navy and the Army along with us, that was a whole additional workload. In some ways, it was like my old days at the Pentagon when I brought along the other services, but this time it would be very different. The advantage I had was they wanted credit, and so they generally would make the changes that I recommended to their courses, and they weren't big changes. They were similar to the changes that we made to our courses. Looking back, I don't think that was a challenge that Colonel Kalar anticipated. My own sense was that this wasn't about just asking for credit for our courses. It was to ensure that we were asking for credit for academic rigorous courses for credit. After all, in some ways, in my head, as an academic colleague of those I had to convince, I had to maintain appropriate credibility, not only to them, but also for my own professional reputation. While all this is unfolding, even though I didn't make major below the zone, I did make major in 1998. For my non-military listeners, major is when an officer moves from company grade to field grade. It's pretty notable because it's the first grade that you compete at a formal promotion board against all of your peers. Field grade officers are major, lieutenant colonel, and colonel in the Air Force, Army, and Marine Corps, and lieutenant commander, and captain in the Navy. One quick way to tell, besides the rank, is that field grade officers have clouds and thunderbolts on the visor of the formal uniform cap that you've likely seen in movies or on the news. When I got promoted to major, a more serious revelation also arrived. At major, you are no longer on a special pay scale that was designed for company-grade officers with prior enlisted service. The other revelation was that, you know, you can be a young captain. After all, you can be a captain after just 4 years of service. Or, well, no, you can't be a young major. On the positive side, the University of Texas at Austin had a policy where field grade officers were automatically promoted to associate professor from assistant professor. The rationale, at least at the time, was that the pay scale was aligned, and they felt that was fair. You may remember that I noted that academic rank is like currency, as it follows you from institution to institution. And even within ROTC, my promotion was certified by the university president. And so that will pay dividends a bit later in my career as well. Oh, by the way, that document is in my safe. One other interesting thing that happened when I made major was that Dr. Mark called me the major. And I kind of liked that. I also felt that my new academic rank would help with the accreditation project, since being an associate professor for line faculty meant that they were tenured, and that showed a level of credibility among peers. I counseled with Dr. Mark often on where he thought my allies were and where I would face more pushback for the project. I started with the allies, and as you would expect, the strongest allies were in government, mathematics, some of the sciences, and business. The most difficult areas were the humanities, the arts, and English. The rest, somewhere in between. Remember, I have to have all the deans across the entire campus to buy in. It was like the movies where there's a vote count of support for an issue. I had a tote board in my office and started to make progress. I knew that Dr. Mark was also helping behind the scenes with his reputation and being the former chancellor of the University of Texas system. Going through history, I learned some of the setbacks that occurred in the past. Some weren't relevant any longer since the files were decades old, and some helped get a sense of what I would be up against. The two biggest were, of course, academic rigor, and then the impression of the value of having ROTC on campus to begin with. By this time, the Navy, Army, and our staff had all the appropriate shifts in the classes' academic rigor that we believed would pass muster. After all, we weren't seeking core credit for any of the disciplines. This is an important foot-stopping point. We were seeking elective credit, and across the university, there were what I would suggest other courses light on academic rigor. So the process is moving along, and there were fits and starts. More often than not, when I would brief Colonel Stripmatter, sadly, some weeks had little news. In my mind, I'm also bumping up against the time that I have left at the University of Texas. I come up with an idea. Now, to get the legislation passed on campus, we would not only need all the deans, we would need the agreement of the provost, who is the chief academic officer of a college or university. We were pretty sure that he was on board, but we weren't entirely sure, and so we were hesitant to ask the question too early in the process, because if we couldn't move it enough through enough deans, then the question would be moot. Moving along, and I say moving along, it's now almost 2 years, and we're getting close. We're just a few away from the goal line. Now, how do you get a decision maker to side with you? Well, I already had some experience in that arena, and I relied on my success with General Russ when I was at ACC, and I got him to approve the new indicators and measures for Air Combat Command. Remember that nervous day? Well, now I'm a bit older and hopefully a bit wiser too. The idea was that to get people to be more agreeable was to meet and provide food. This came with some fits and starts as well, but we finally got the regional office to approve funds for a working lunch with the provost and other senior leaders, including Dr. Mark and the deans from the largest schools, and you'll see why that in a bit. Of course, I have an amazing briefing, and Dr. Mark had done some sleuthing for me as well. And he told me that he believed that the provost was likely amenable to the plan if we had the votes. I'm getting close to the end of the briefing. See that the clock is ticking, and I know that we can't keep him longer than the allotted time, as he's a very busy leader. And I did my famous walk from the podium toward him at the crucial point in the presentation. As I walk from the podium along the side of the table toward the provost, I give the elevator speech of why this is important and how it will affect students from all the ROTC programs, pulling a little on the heartstrings about national pride and all that. I stop less than 3 feet from the provost and I say, I have a senior who is graduating this term and will be an Air Force pilot. In reviewing his transcript, I noticed that he took a course called puppetry and earned 3 elective credits. No disrespect to the humanities, it seems like the courses in leadership, national security, and communication stack up pretty well. And that's almost a quote from what I said. I remember it quite well, and he paused for a moment or two. Then he said, and I'm paraphrasing, "I understand the issue and agree it's both important and of value to our students in the Air Force. I don't think we can get the votes." With that, the meeting did end on time and he left. As he left, he assured me that he would continue on his part to do what he could to move the last couple of deans. Driving from the university to the Circle C development took me down the famous MOPAC, and just before I would exit from my place, there was a Walmart on one side of the road and a Target on the other. This gave me an idea. While hardly real business research, I would keep an eye on both parking lots. Which one would be fuller at the various times that I'm going along the road? Almost always, it was Walmart. Then I had another idea. At the time, there was a lot of financial news about the different companies that sold women's apparel. Two stood out, Ann Taylor and Talbots. I would go to the mall and watch the traffic for both. Sometimes I'd go in and chat with the salespeople as a potential customer to see what was popular. Sure, it was anecdotal, and yet thinking that if you blended observations with business news, there might be something there. I haven't followed apparel companies for a long time and rarely invest in big box retail. Today, there are often commentators who will be talking about a retail company and mention their observations about what they see in terms of customer flow and interest in merchandise. Maybe I was onto something. I'd add that if you have outlet stores near where you are, consider what you see in the outlets. If something didn't sell in their retail stores and isn't selling at the outlet, maybe there's something about their merchandise. How about this? Does a store have sales all the time? Or is it really select items, meaning that they are getting full retail prices? I get emails from CVS all the time. Every week, they send a 20% coupon off one regular priced item. Then you can notice that about a month or so before the end of the quarter, you might see 32% off coupons for the entire purchase, or that 20% coupon is 40% for a couple of weeks. That tells me that they're trying to pump up the top line sales number. Now, maybe not. Everything in the business world is a clue. To be good investors, we have to figure out which clues are investable and which clues are nothing at all. This week, there was an article that I posted on my Facebook page talking about whether it's smart or not to pay a financial advisor, in the article, 1%, to manage their account. And I said never. First, most aren't 1%. From my research, they're somewhere between 3 and 7%. And remember, you pay them whether you make money or lose money because the fee is based on the value of the portfolio. And most people, the average bear, can make more than the average S&P 500, which is the measurement that is probably the most neutral between the Dow and the NASDAQ. I share this because I actually taught an informal course on the markets, and it was approved by the university. And what we did was we took the Yahoo Finance page, because at the time you could pretend to invest and see how well you would have done. And it included adding in fees, which no longer exist, and you could tell whether or not you would have made money or lost money using a fake account. Now, in that particular class, one of my students picked the top stock in the NASDAQ and the top stock in the S&P 500. And while that is purely coincidental, the reality is that with a little research, you can make money in the market. And with ETFs and spiders and all kinds of different ways that you can invest in today's market, You can do so in ways that don't take a lot of time. I'm sure that if you have a 401k, then you already know that you can make money by investing over a long period of time, and compounding really works. Of course, you can also lose a lot of money in a short period of time, and I'll share a story about that in a future episode. Lastly, I'll say that my new podcast I'm getting ready to launch will include business and financial news in each episode. Well, that's my time, folks, and as you can see, there is more to come. Next week, we'll start to wrap up my time at the University of Texas with more stories and adventures. Have a great week, and hook 'em horns.